Have you finished? Have you finished?
Yeah.
Good. This is a very exciting event. The three persons other than myself whom you see at this table are three of the most wonderful people in the world. Robert Creeley, Robin Blazer, Michael Ondaatje. In wanting to arrive at something for this panel that could be called a theme, which in fact would not instantly preclude the possibility of human behavior on the part of these people, we managed to come up with personal geography, or put it geography, both personal and literary. All three of these persons have traveled extensively, and it has informed their writing as well, obviously, as their lives. And I'm going to talk as little as possible. I'm not going to give you one of those awful intros that ends up dominating the afternoon. I'm simply going to say, here they are, and the sooner they start talking, the better we'll all feel about it. Robin, would you like to begin? Or would you like... Michael, would you like to begin?
I think Robin...
Bob, alphabetically. Would you like to start?
No.
They none of them want to start. Robin, come on.
Well, these two are foreigners. Where I'm concerned. This is my country. I was born in Denver, Colorado, in 1925. I was hidden here by the Sacred Heart Nuns, who are Jesuit sisters of the Jesuit Society. Smart and dangerous people. For 5 months, I was illegitimate. And then left Denver, only to return when Naropa has invited me. After that, I am in Idaho. And there is a Blazer, Idaho. And I suggest that you go look at it. It's by the Portneuf River. There, if you look in the Rand McNally Atlas, you will find it listed with no population. There are two shacks there, at some distance apart, humming with machinery of some kind, probably, I suppose, to change tracks or something, because it is a railroad that runs right there by the river. One is called East Blazer, and the other one West Blazer. It is not far from Bancroft, Idaho, named for the wonderful historian. And that place is nearly a ghost town. But there is a graveyard there in which my great-great-grandmother, my grandmother, and my aunt, Tina, Tina, as she said it, West, is buried. Well, Aunt Tina is not. She's buried in Twin Falls, her brother, Uncle Mitchell West. All of this is in my poetry somewhere. You know, the pioneers. So this is my country, and we lived in places during the Depression. 1925 leads you directly into the depths of the Depression. My grandmother had just enough pull to become a telegrapher on the railroad, the Union Pacific. So we lived by the railroad very, very often, in fact, in between two tracks sometimes, where she, as telegrapher, sent the messages by Morse code. They don't do that anymore. There were hoops made out of bamboo, bent bamboo, that you held the messages up to the train as the steam engine flashed by. Me holding her skirts. I was not exactly welcome to my father. It took him 5 months to come to terms with me. And so I was often sent off to my grandmother. Wapai, Kamaima, Orchard. Now, Orchard, Idaho is an interesting place to go. there is nothing there except a water tower, which amazed me because it dripped. And can you imagine, in the middle of a sagebrush desert, there would be frogs. And I've still not answered in my poetry where the frogs came from. So, you see, this is my country. When I had a so-called nervous breakdown, which was at 14, and I'm certain was sexually centered, they sent me off to a sheep ranch in Wyoming. Where I thoroughly enjoyed being with the cowboys, who were very kind to me, and they decided that I should wrangle the cows. Now, I was very good at that. And no one told me until after I had left that the horse did it. It was a wrangling horse that knew exactly how to bring the cows home, and it wouldn't have needed me at all. But it was my first experience of a kind of genius, wrangling the cows, and so forth. I could go on with my belonging in this country, and the reason we got east and even further east on my left and my right. So is that enough to say where you came from?
Why don't you keep going until you actually arrive at yourself as a writer?
Oh.
Don't you think?
He wants to talk as a cowboy.
Yeah, I'll start with a cowboy, yeah. Well, I could ride a horse. It was rather good. My father kept palominos in late years, and then he got lazy and fed them sugar, so we had fat palominos. And they are not particularly good to ride. This was in Twin Falls, which is right on the Snake River with that marvelous canyon and the magic of that, and the second canyon that goes around it called Rock Creek Canyon. And so the canyon world is a wonderful one. Now, when did you become a writer? I was writing even then, and nearly always my mother fixed them up. So they really, the poems, sort of two of them were published in the local paper, the Twin Falls Tribune, I think it was then called, and she was better at rhyming than I was. So I remember one I wrote was called The Barn Story, and it was the barn talking when Christ was born. The barn was very interesting, in perfect rhyme, pretty much done by my mother, but I published them under my name. And, well, there were others. And then the next move towards writing would have been, well, I was a reader all the time. Because one thing, when you're not the welcomest child, you learn to read early. It's very good for you. And then you spend all of your time reading. And then they think you're a good boy. I was not a good boy in any sense. But I would do my music lessons like nobody's business, years and years and years of it. And all of this is sort of a way, and I'm trying to say that all of this becomes ground for the sense of measure in the language, for all of the stuff and being able to read, and then remaining, what I find kind of fascinating, I don't know about all of you, but there we were not in the 20th century, except for the Depression. Never got there. I was trying to quote earlier, and I'm not going to go far with it, by the shores of Gitche-Gumee, by the big and deep sea waters at the teepee of Nokomis. That's the kind of poetry I knew when I got there, that is, to the 20th century. So we are in the 40s, so to speak, when you're still writing carefully rhymed little poems and being a very good little Catholic boy, even though I was considered a bastard. And the writing would probably have stopped except for winding up in 1945 in Berkeley. There was a lot of drama, which I might bring up because that brought in, and I don't know and I cannot remember the name of the author. There were photographs in the paper which, when I went home for my 50th anniversary from high school in Twin Falls, Idaho, someone had dared to keep. I played the part of Charlie's aunt, Now, do you know the story of Charlie's aunt? Aha. Well, I looked very good in drag. They thought I was Charlie's aunt. You see, I'm a cover for my roommate and girlfriend and so on and so forth. The man said to me, I have been all over the world, the man whose mother collected these photographs, he said, I've been all over the world. I've seen Charlie's aunt in London repeatedly. You were the best there ever was. I can believe it, because some of the people forgot their lines, and I had to ad-lib with my girdle. There's a girdle scene, and so on. So anyway, this is all training for writing, very seriously. So then you come into, I went to Northwestern. I received a little fellowship in Chicago, north of Evanston. And then finally the College of Idaho. And that's in Caldwell, Idaho. And the dean called my mother and said, he sticks out like a sore thumb. Send him someplace else. I don't know what that meant, and I let you guess. Anyway, I went to Berkeley. There, I ran into many, many marvelous people. And the trouble with those histories of Berkeley, San Francisco Renaissance, and the term Berkeley Renaissance comes from Rex Ross having named Berkeley, Berkeley Renaissance, and then it was picked up by Ferlinghetti and turned into the San Francisco Renaissance from that term. But the trouble is that the many, many marvelous people, Berkeley is a university that is a town of its own. As a consequence, it's not, if you have the experience at university of a commuter university, this is a very different thing. What they did in Buffalo, when they had the University of Buffalo, of New York, Buffalo downtown, this wonderful place downtown. Then they had the student riots and stuff, and they decided to get an architect to fix it so you could never gather any place, and they moved it 17 miles out of town. And there it is, 17 miles out of town, all in Dur brick. Now, there is a Dur kind of brick, okay? Dour, however you say it. And so anyway, so get Berkeley, San Francisco, and this is get us to writing in a minute. And then this was, of course, the meeting among all those wonderful people in a, in a university town where you live in the university itself. There are what we call them, using German to be funny, a Wege Studenten. These are students that never leave. Robert Duncan's Greek tutor and my Greek tutor was a girl from Puerto Rico who didn't like to be told anybody to know that. She was Spanish, but she had superb Greek, but she couldn't pass astronomy. So I went in and took the astronomy test and got caught. Well, fortunately, they didn't expel me. I don't know why. But anyway, she never got a degree of any kind. And we both had this high-level classicist, Rosario Jimenez, to be remembered forever. He says, well, that's where the writing begins. And there was a group called the Writers Conference where we all met. And this went very well. Duncan's Venice poem was given there, and some of my very early tentative stuff was given there. And Jack Spicer was beginning those wonderful early poems that come out in a little volume called One Night Stand. All of this, and Robert Duncan was 7 years older, and he'd been in New York, and you know what New York does to you. Well, he had all the sophistication in the world. He'd run into the surrealism, but we got it all. It just began to flow. William Carlos Williams Patterson was just appearing, the Four Quartets of Eliot just appearing, and all this stuff, and we met in groups, and Jack and Duncan and I would read these things out loud, and so on and so forth. Duncan set up a thing called, at his place, Throckmorton, which was an old house where they all rented a place, and because you couldn't study 20th century poetry properly at all in Berkeley, it was all set up there. So you read Finnegan's Wake together. It took 40 people to get through a few pages to have the adequate, and all this stuff and so on. Well, the writing then begins at this point and the challenge, beginning with Wallace Stevens for most of us, harmonium and so forth, and then it moves forward and you begin to try to write. And you begin to try to be in the 20th century, at least I do. Duncan was already in the 20th century. I don't think Jack was in the same sense at all. You didn't know the writing, you didn't know the writers, and all of it had to flow in. And it becomes like what Olson called time as the life of space. You suddenly realized that your whole space became alive as the time you spent on this stuff.
Yeah,
I like easy chairs. Okay, well, isn't that adequate?
No. Closer.
All right.
We can come back.
Because
we're expecting all your secrets.
This writing, the only poem that's kept from this period is in the Holy Forest, inside a poem called Lake of Souls, and it's called Christ in Heaven, Dance with Me. And you'll see there's already a little problem with Western metaphysics going on in my young and unformed mind. I stuck it in there because I sort of like it still. And it was reviewed in the College of the University magazine. And the reviewer, by Keith Jones, a wonderful, he's now a union leader, big in the great problem in California. But he reviewed it with great pleasure, and the student newspaper made fun of it all and said, "Keith Jones, dance with me." They rewrote it. My reviewer was turning. We were picking up on it. Something going on. So there's my story of the first poem I want anybody to know about. I hope the Twin Falls newspapers are rotting somewhere.
Michael, would you like to go?
Okay. I also wanted to be a cowboy, and the problem was I was born and lived in Sri Lanka, which didn't have too many cowboys. But there was a rumor of cowboys and Billy the Kid, etc. And at the back of Billy the Kid, there's a photograph of what looks like an eight-year-old boy wearing a very dashing cowboy outfit with, you know, emeralds on the belt and stuff like that, which was me. And what's very interesting about how one becomes a writer or how one becomes anything is how there's this kind of leapfrogging thing that happens. You know, you grow up in one place and your real brothers and sisters are 5,000 miles away. And those who they may be all your ideal teachers as well. And I think that's what's, you know, evident, I think, with all three of us, probably. One has to travel to find your home, I suspect. I was in Sri Lanka a few years ago, and there's a wonderful dancer there named Chitrasena. He's now about 80, and he had really revolutionized dance in Sri Lanka. He'd turned it from performances done by foreigners to a much more local, regional dance subject. The subjects were much more local and regional. And I asked him what was his biggest influence, what made him a dancer. And he said it was reading the autobiography of Isadora Duncan. And I thought this was the most amazing thing. Here's a dancer who had never seen her dance, but somehow through that book had kind of witnessed the possibility of what he could do. And I think this is so common among us as writers that this happens, or it's any kind of, in any art form. Because I think geography is, it's quite surreal, that, you know, just as history is. I mean, I was hearing the other day that there's a whole group of people in America who are reenactors of the Civil War. Do you know about these people? I mean, perhaps this is quite normal. Everyone knows about this, but you know, I was quite stunned that about thousands of people going on. You know, in every time there's a Civil War movie or a TV movie, they go around and they kind of audition for it, and they never eat Granny Smith apples because they weren't invented then, and they perfected the Gettysburg bloat, you know, and all this stuff, and. So, I mean, if history is kind of moving in this kind of realism in a kind of false way, and geography does the same thing, I think, it's very difficult to know where you really belong anyway. So I was born in Sri Lanka. I lived there till I was 11. And I had no idea I wanted to be a writer until I was about 19, I suspect. And the idea seemed to be impossible. And wasn't even a reality in my head or a desire. I didn't know what I wanted to be. And I went to school in England when I was about 11, which was sort of a tradition of middle-class families in Sri Lanka. You went off to England, you went to school there, and you came back and you took over the family law firm. That was the kind of, you know, method. And I think our generation was the first one that didn't really go back. So I went to school in England, which I didn't like at all. And then when I was about 18, came to Canada. And it was there, really, that I kind of suddenly discovered English at university and writing at university, mainly because I had a wonderful teacher who would read Robert Browning at the drop of a hat, you know, and just read it and perform it in front of you and then just leave the classroom and time the exit with the bell ringing. And everyone wanted to be Robert Browning and wanted to write dramatic monologues. And I think that's what I started writing at that point. And so that's what happened to me. But it seems to me that, you know, I mean, there is this kind of, in the way that Chitrasena the dancer and Isadora Duncan connected up, what to me is most interesting and what is most moving is this dialogue that happens in these kind of leaps across geography. And not just in terms of geography, but also history. I was at the Sackler Gallery in Washington recently, and I saw a series of bamboo drawings which had been done many, many hundred years ago, but they've been based on a stone carving that had been done 300 years earlier and had been shattered by some emperor. And this artist had gone there and for years lived there and done his version of these of this broken stone and what the drawn bamboo on the stone had represented to him. So I mean, to me, that kind of dialogue between generations and you know, over 300 years or between people 50 years apart or 30 years apart is the most moving thing in terms of what a geography is.
Thank you.
Okay.
Bob.
A few weeks ago in New York, I met a curious and engaging man who whose responsibility is, I believe, the finances of New York. And he'd apparently been hired by Buffalo to do a financial précis or make a judgment on the city's situation. And as he told me, he said, there's only one thing wrong with Buffalo. It's in the wrong place. He said, actually, it's not part of New York at all. It's would be much more aptly joined to Canada, for example. It would be equally aptly joined to Ohio. It's the Middle West. So it's at the farthest possible reach from its active financial and defining center. He said, now, if you could just move it down to someplace a little north of Poughkeepsie, your troubles would be over. So there one is. I've lived in Buffalo since 1966 in some particular and continuing manner. And I was thinking just that tonight is going to be a contest for me personally that the Buffalo Sabres are playing in the fifth game with the Dallas Stars, which you remember wiped out Colorado a few weeks ago. And it isn't just the sort of the giant killer, but Buffalo's economy is so defined by that game. In other words, the payroll for the Buffalo Sabres is about 1/20th out of the Buffalo, of the Dallas Stars, and so on. All it goes on like that. Buffalo is that kind of place. In the city now, it's on every street corner is some terrific manifest of "Go Sabres, go," etc. The place is in a beautifully manic and terrific mood, and the last game, the fourth game, was just wonderful. So that is. Fact of being somewhere. I begin to recognize, I had a seminar, like they say, as a teacher this spring, which was, it had a curious title, Poetry's Public. And it began with I just used four texts. One was Eric Havelock's The Muse Learns to Write, which gives a quick, succinct, and beautifully compact sense of the shift from an oral tradition to a literate tradition. It's written also an extraordinarily sweet book. The author is 85 at the time he's writing this, and he's waited all these years to summarize his opinions for fear they would have made an awful chaos and mess in the whole field of linguistics and classical studies had he published them earlier. So he now recognizes he's beyond such argument and writes this terrific, beautiful book. And in it, he says such simply clarifying things. He asks the reader, not glibly, to think of what happens when you ask someone what it means. Someone is saying something, and then the Socratic trick was to say, what do you mean by that? You were talking, but suddenly you're given this peculiar, displacing objectivity, specious, utterly abstract, and no existence whatsoever, and ask what you mean by what you're meaning. And it's, I think, why I've held to poetry as like the veritable lifeline, is that in poetry, meaning what you're meaning is what you're meaning. There's no other meaning. But what you mean. And it's immensely good company. And it's also in the same course as we ended up with Jack's, the house that Jack built, which is, I must say, a beautiful place to come home. And at that point, various dear people in the class were bringing in, lots of Jack's poetry as well. So it became a really extraordinary. And it made clear to me, I'd known for you from your terrific and extraordinarily useful essay, Outside and Inside, but just at that moment, it all became so specific in reading what Jack was saying and the ways he was thinking. And the presumption, of course, in poetry, not really, rarely, if ever, by poets, that one is somehow owning that which one does, is a rare mistake for a poet to make. I remember Robert saying years ago, when one first writes a poem that satisfies one's imagination of a poem, there's a great feeling of elation that I've written this poem. But after a very short time indeed, that's not a remarkable interest anymore. Not that, hey, I can write a poem, but it's poetry being, poetry is, the poems are what is interesting, not that I or you or someone else is writing them. So coincidentally, just at the end of this business in Buffalo, it happened that we had a visitor, not to my part of the scene, but to Charlie Kiles, a very brilliant old-time person there, particularly involved with instruments, music, all over the world. And he brought up a friend of his from NYU, as it was, named Christopher Small, who's an Englishman, who's fascinated by the... he puts it very simply, music is not a noun. And I thought, poetry isn't a noun either. Come to think of it, it certainly doesn't become a noun, and it isn't a thing. It's an activity. It's so that Christopher Small would say of music that there's not music. There's musicking, and it isn't simply. It's the act of music making, and that really suddenly flashed in my thinking very vividly. The confusions I've had even about the word poem became suddenly quite clear. But equally, kind of curious things such as how is it that we have, thousands of people making poems, writing poems, but very damn few reading them. Making them is a great deal more fun than watching someone else. In other words, we're doing something rather than producing objects of discrete order. That's, again, it tied in with senses of Zukofsky writing one poem all's one's life. Whitman, almost like Turner in the Tate, kept painting the paintings. Whitman, the backward glance, more just, or Duncan, or any of us for that matter. It's something we're doing, not something we're ending or concluding. And this was to me its wonder. And again, in my own thinking or life or habits, it's been almost impossible for me to secure any sense of what it is, As we were talking or thinking about it, it's always amazing to me how ranging and diverse a sense of possibility it actually permits. It rarely, if ever, seems to have a, someone says no one reads poems anymore. Well, no one ever did in that finite manner. I mean, no one ever had a particular object that he or she in poetry was affixed to, and this was forever what was read or somehow. It's always part of something. It's always an activity rather than a substance that's secured. I think in that way, it's like novels. It's like it's doing something. And that, again, thinking of place, as Michael has been talking about it, and Robin also, I was the youngest in my family, and my father died when I was about five. And he had been married once before, so I had two half-brothers from that previous fact, whom I never really knew, except in a very marginal way. So I had a sense always of being in a curious, displaced place. I grew up in the country, but my father's actual life had been in the city. A few years ago, my sister, we went to see the house that I would have come back to as a baby on Mount Auburn Street in Watertown. And my sister was incredible. She could still remember the license plate of the car and the phone number. This would be back to, it would be about 1922 or 3. It was incredible. And she talked her way into the house charmingly and went up and showed the lady where this was and where that was. And as we're coming out, we now want to go over to Belmont, where my grandfather, my father's father, had lived. And I suddenly see Center Street. And I remember that poem. I have a poem called I, and acquired so many acres of Belmont land, and through which the heart of the present Creeley Road runs, Center Street. So I just on impulse turned left on Center Street, and sure enough, it took me right over to Belmont and put me right on the backside of my, what was the echo of my grandfather's farm. But it was still a world that I had never actually found place in. If I go to where I'm at home, I go into my mother's family, although I never was there, except in displacement, as we're all living in Massachusetts. The real home that I have as an emotional or social person is probably Maine, where, as my wife says, they understand my jokes and ways of thinking. And I don't even think of it. I mean, I just feel completely at ease in that language. And I suppose what I'm trying in a curious way to say is that I'm fascinated by the way that particularly Americans, I was thinking of Maine specifically, Edwin Arlington Robinson, or Edna St. Vincent Millay, or these curious surviving poets, Marsden Hartley, how they have, it seems, to invent the whole conditions, as though you had to learn to play baseball with no clue except that there's some kind of a ball and some kind of a bat, and you contrive the whole thing out of whole cloth. I feel as though I've done that. And I felt, not simply in paranoia, but I know there's been a certain resentment that was what I seemed to have to offer the world, was this curiously homemade act. But I loved it, that poetry, of all the things one could humanly do, seemed to have the most, not capability or flexibility, but it seemed the most provident and securing of this need. How to get said what must be said, or it seemed to me, or the words that came to me made solely of air, etc. Or Allen Ginsberg's Some of My Time Now Given to Nothingness. But this aspect of this fact of being human was most provided for in this act of poetry.
Thank you.
I'm in.
Well, I was just picking up on Bob's making it out of whole cloth. I just think it's a wonderful term. I was whispering to Bob, that's what Duncan would say about the West Coast experience, that we made it out of whole cloth. There was nothing to go on. That relates to my sense, you're not in the 20th century, so what are you going to do? I mean, what are you writing like? Maybe you're writing wonderful things in the manner of Shelley or whatever, but it's not whatever this whole cloth thing is that one does when it is your own activity. In fact, I think that relates to Spicer's sense of dictation, that you didn't own the language, you didn't own the poem, and certainly there's not an ownership of activity. That's simply life moving one way or another.
When I was living in Japan, there was a sense among painting, in Japanese painting, that if the painting was imperfect enough, you could sign it.
You what?
You could sign it.
It was imperfect.
Imperfect enough.
Mm-hmm. But the point, yes, but the point at which the painting, in fact, was a manifested thing of its own, you no longer had the right to sign it, because then it was its own, and you had simply allowed it to arrive.
I very much believe that I remember one time with William Carlos Williams sending him a poem which he really liked, and then he said, in saying so, he then says, but of course we know when something like this happens that the person writing is not responsible. You know, but, which was the very point. Yeah, in other words, one knows when one gets to that point of clarity or capability, it's no longer, you know, me thinking I will do this. It doesn't. In fact, to me, again, I was always semi, in some way, embarrassed that what was most effective, let's say, as quote poetry, was that which took the least possible effort. I mean, that it was, if and as it really worked, there wasn't any effort in it at all. I didn't have to revise, I didn't have to do anything. I just had to write it down. And I don't know why that's the case or whether that's good or bad.
Very
and
good.
I don't care.
Very good.
It's a little late for that.
Very good.
Michael, say something.
Well, going back to that issue of the leaping from geography to geography, I just finished, I'm halfway through this biography of Truffaut that just came out. And last year, for my trashy summer reading, I read the book Easy Riders, Raging Bulls, which is about the American film industry from around the era of Spielberg and Dennis Hopper and everybody else, and which is, you know, trashy but fascinating. And the Truffaut book, I mean, what's you cannot believe these people are living on the same planet. You know, I mean, no one would want to pick up the collected letters of Steven Spielberg or anything like that. But I mean, the point about Truffaut, from the age of 15, he wrote 3 or 4 letters a day, read 2 or 3 books a week, and saw 2 movies a day, and had a job, and went to jail by the time he was 18, and had syphilis. So I mean, this kind of there was a full life going on, which I don't think the American film directors had until they became very rich. But it's a very interesting, you know, this is a few years down the line, but you can see the great gap that there is between, you know, one kind of civilization and another one. I don't know why, but this seemed to be an example of different kinds of effects of different geographies.
You know, this topic came about because Bob and I, talking about what we could do this afternoon, last evening, every time I'd bring up, I'd say, well, what if we, and Bob would say, oh, no, no. And I said, well, what do you think would be interesting? And he said, if we talked about geography, we could find out why Michael ended up in Canada. How did he get from Sri Lanka to Canada? And what was the drive, and what did you mean by that, Michael?
The drive? The drive to Canada was accidental. I said I didn't like England very much. I find it very racist and very limiting. I mean, I just felt that there was, once you finished school, there was nothing you could do. I mean, this was just pre-Beatles, so there was a kind of huge class gap before that. And my brother had come to Canada before that, before me, and he said, well, come here, this is a great place. So something as simple as that, it's just I come out there, and I came to Canada at that point. There wasn't any kind of vision that I should go west, you know. But I'm glad I did. You know, I couldn't imagine being a writer in England or Sri Lanka, which is one of the sad things, because I think there's an amazing culture there, which, you know, was until recently very much an oral tradition. There were very few books about the place. It was always told as stories from one person to another. And when I was running the family, one of the things I wanted to do was to try and translate that verbal storytelling into something that could go onto the page. But, you know, I mean, I've been working on a book now that's sort of set in Sri Lanka, and it's been very difficult because I'm sort of writing about what I don't know. It's about a community that has nothing to do with the community that I grew up in, so that it's much more tentative and to do with much more research in some way than I had done with running the family, which was just kind of given to me over various meals and teas. But trying to write about a place you grew up in, but about a community that you were not really a part of, has been very difficult.
What was your schooling? Where did you go to school?
In Sri Lanka, I went to school called St. Thomas's College. And I met a friend there in Sri Lanka recently, and somebody had given a new cricket pitch or something to the school, and his friend said, "But first, we want a decent toilet." You know, and that was the kind of that was a little thing about that school. But then I went to school in England, to a school called Dulwich College, which actually was quite famous because P.G. Woodhouse went there, and Ernest Shackleton. Different ends of the earth, you know, so prose style and adventure. But it was a school that really wanted you to do sports and not anything else. So it was, I had a kind of ironic knowledge battle with the school most of the time. I think most of my schooling came after school.
Yeah.
Even after university, I think. And actually that happened, I guess, with Coach House Press, because where I, when I was at university, I kind of accidentally came upon, and which was a small press in Toronto, which was set up by Stan Bevington and two other people, and in the mid-60s, late-60s, and I fell in with them, luckily, and that was where I really learned about contemporary writing from writers like Victor Coleman and B.B. Nichol and others who were there. I know I was quite naive about what writing was until that time.
Some time back, I was loaned a book by Jack Green, which he said belonged to Lisa, but which he was intent on having me read. And they very decently then gave it to me. What's the name of that guy?
William Calvin.
And what's the name of the book? Cerebral Symphony. In that book, there's a description of a one-celled organism that lives its life by flopping. It flops, and it flops, and it flops, and then there's an atmosphere of sustenance. And when it arrives at sustenance, it stays there until there is no feeling of sustenance, at which point it flops. And that's its major description. It flops into what it needs, and then it stays there until it's used up, and then it flops some more. And I have and as I read that, I thought, that's the way I've lived my life. That's and that line of Michael's, you move to find your home. Isn't that what you just said? You move to arrive at your home. You move to arrive at your home. You move to sustenance. And I mean, within a situation like this, where the people in the tent here are really hoping that these three people are going to tell them how to write, so they can finally just get on with it. I think that everything that you find is going to happen here is that people are more and more going to say that what you're doing is the job description and that the insecurities and the flop of it are pretty much what you're now dedicated to as a lifestyle. So that if you have any question of why your parents have questions, that just might be it. They think when you're flopping, you're just flopping.
Stay away. Well, yeah. Well, I would say that the only problem with flopping is that there are a lot of obstacles to the flop. And this is leading me to ask Michael if he... One wonderful day, a postcard arrived from Michael, and it was Ganesh from someplace in Sri Lanka. Wasn't it chalk, Ganesh?
Yeah.
On a tree trunk, and there were offerings in front of it. Well, it set me off, one, to find out exactly what Ganesh could be. And as my own sense of the guardianship of Ganesh, and I now have Ganesh around me. Thank you, Michael, very much. He's a guardian of all obstacles. So that the one needs, in terms of writing at any rate, I think it's a constant, journey through obstacles, in my sense. And I mean by that even the fundamental musicality of the language, that one has to pick it up, and it's an awfully good idea, I think, to be in touch with the musicians and so on as little companions or big companions or whatever of what you're... Or if you do have a cliché, it's there because you know it's a cliché and value the cliché of it. So I would ask, as a writer, if you don't mind me making this, or a flopper, that I had my Ganesh. I gave my friend David one that I very particularly like. It's a Ganesh who is a child with the elephant trunk. You know, Michael would be best to describe Ganesh. He's playing with a ball and running, so he's stretched out with the ball caught in the elephant trunk of this wonderful spirit, guardianship of the thing, and that's, you keep that in your office, David, don't you? David's a social worker where there are lots of problems with flops. And so, but the Ganesh thing, would you mind saying something about the wonder of Ganesh?
No, I don't know much more than the fact that he's to do with removing some of the obstacles. I did see a great Ganesh recently in Washington. They have a goddess show, which is remarkable show on, and one of them there's in that show is a Ganesh being suckled by his mother, which I've never seen before. You know, and it's like pulling this little elephant to your breast. You know, that's very sweet. But I mean, the flopping is interesting because a friend of mine who's an architect in Sri Lanka who I travel around with, he said 80% of all architecture is loitering, which is close to flopping. And I think actually, all for me as a writer, I feel that loitering is a very central necessity, especially when you're starting something you don't know even for 5 years what you're in fact doing. It's a sense of, you know, just hanging around and picking up this door jam and moving into another house and this window frame. I mean, one of the things about architecture in Sri Lanka is that there is no then and now. Everything is present, so you do take window frames from old houses that have fallen down, and then you bring it to a new house, or a water spout is the same as it was, you know, 8 centuries back. So that there is a tradition, and that's why you loiter. And I think that's very close to, I think, what one does as a writer as well. I mean, it's going back to that thing about dialogues. I find that's what's most moving to me as a writer and as a reader now, to try and understand that link up with other times and places. You know, there's a book by this man, W.G. Sebald, called The Rings of Saturn, which is a wonderful book, about a man just walking along the east coast of England, but it takes in China, it takes in Thomas Brown, it takes in five or six very, very different places within its narrative.
When I first married and went to Denmark, I was living in a house that had English language books, well, briefly for a month before we went to London, a house that had English language books and magazines because my first husband's brother-in-law was teaching English at the Aarhus University. And one of the things which I found there to my delight was a copy of the Harvard Wake, which was called the E.E. Cummings number. And I adored E.E. Cummings. He's one of the poets I memorized extensively, and another one was D.H. Lawrence. I was capable of quoting a lot of D.H. Lawrence and E.E. Cummings. And so I got to read not only the E.E. Cummings, but there was an unpublished, wasn't there, Bob, an unpublished poem in that by D.H. Lawrence?
Yeah.
In that same. Years went by, and when I met Robert Creeley, it turned out that he and two friends of his, Race Newton and Buddy Berlin, you might recognize the name Berlin as Lucia Berlin. He and Lucia were married for a time, but those three persons had published that particular issue of the Harvard Wake, which brings me to the sense of within all of this business of traveling, you also arrive at the friends who matter to you for the rest of your life. And those two friends were in Albuquerque, New Mexico, which is why you came to Albuquerque, New Mexico, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely.
You told me once that when you were at Harvard, Kenneth Koch invited you up to his room to drink a bit of sherry and to listen to him read you a poem of his.
How did he create
this event? Well, Why did he think you'd want to hear it?
We were shyly known to each other as aspiring writers. And he lived in Lowell House, I remember, and I lived in Adam's house, which was more, it was not quite as socially set, and it was in different vibes. But in any case, he was a very shy man. He had an extraordinary stuttering problem at that time, and so on. But I asked him later. He said a charming thing. He said, "I didn't know you were going to Harvard. I thought you just lived around there." This is my old friend Kenneth. I said, "I went to Harvard. I was, you know." And but he had typed these immaculately. I remember that on this sort of onion skin bond paper, and he sat me down with these five or six poems, and he poured me a little glass of sherry. Then he retired, as I remember. And went out of the room for a discreet period while I was muse on his poetry, and then returned, and I said, "You know, this is very interesting." And returned the poems to him, and we became very particular friends in a curious way. But thinking of that time too, of another friend of those days, Jacob Lee, whom I then knew as Bob Lee, he's writing a curious reminiscence of his growing up and now college, in which he has me, in a way, I can speak of it because it's years ago, in a way that's interesting to me, because I mean, I had no objective sense of what I was like or who I even was. But he recalls that, unlike himself and other friends, I took everything, not so much personally, but he said it was interesting. I didn't seem to follow the disposition of the class or the teacher or any qualifying attitude. It wasn't that I was contesting, but then until I came to be able myself to think this is interesting, I didn't accept any other mode of relation to it. So that I took things much more not hard, but I took them much more seriously and much more energetically. And he said, you know, sitting in a, we used to sit and drink beer for all hours. He remembers me getting, you know, yelling with delight, things like that, which again was not characteristic behavior. And he also remembers the curious displacement of the gang when I suddenly stopped going to college entirely, you know, which I was thrown out, that helps. But I made no effort to return, which was difficult, as you remember, in Albuquerque, to be 30 plus and have no viable degree of any kind. I think it's not a recommendation to you in your own habits or possibilities as writers, but I do remember an old-time person of that time in Albuquerque, Winfield Townley Scott, saying, someone was asking him about, I said, if you don't have to do it, don't do it. And I remember Carl Riccozzi here in Naropa saying, preparing to deal with a pleasant workshop, saying, in a kind of lovely musing, said, well, the last thing they need is encouragement. Which, in an old-fashioned sense, is absolutely true. It's nice to get encouragement, but poets don't remarkably need it. At least I can recall years and years without encouragement. In fact, even a tacit wish that I would do something else. You know, my mother saying I'd like to think Bob could get a job if he had to, and things of that sort. It's not a very simply defined occupation. If you check it out in things like the Encyclopedia Britannica, there's an interesting discussion as to whether it constitutes a profession at all. The numbers of persons supporting themselves through the exercise of poetry as a profession is very, very small. And so that if you look in the dictionary, it says a poet writes poetry, and poetry is what a poet writes. It's a completely circular definition. So
I love it.
I love that years ago, that fellow saying, this was John Frederick Nims, I remember, we'd had lunch with him. He told about a friend of his in the Middle West who'd had this reading. And at the end of the reading, he invited questions. And someone said, oh, that next last poem you read, was that a real poem, or did you just make it up yourself? You might consider that friends and neighbors.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a good question to ask. Was this a real poem, or did I just make it up myself? And what is a real poem? Bang.
One of the things...
You should invite questions.
One of the things I hear surfacing here, that business of I hear... I remember for a while when I was going to a psychiatrist, actually, I think she was a psychiatrist. There was this, she was absolutely wonderful, but at regular intervals she'd say, what I seem to be hearing here is, and I finally said, I really would like to mention how uncomfortable it makes me when you say what I seem to be hearing, because my own experience was that she and I were having a conversation. And she and suddenly it was like I was there all by myself, and this person was off here with some kind of sublime overview. So, but what I seem to be hearing here is, I know with Michael's statement of going to... Toronto and finding the friends you found there, and that was the sense of when your education started. Mm-hmm. And with Bob going to Harvard, but the thing that really happened there were the friends that you made there and the information you got from them. And with Robin arriving in Berkeley and arriving at company, I would like to suggest that there seems to be a resonating sense here of arriving at company, and I wonder whether the three of you would address that. I mean, I don't mean I wonder whether you would. What I really mean is, would you please
address the issue of company?
Yes.
Well, suddenly at Coach House, there was the company that was there was, I think this is what you're talking about, a group of peers who you learned from in an unofficial way, in an unpublic way. And the very fact that Kochar's Press had a very small audience allowed you to try out things and discover your bad moments as much as your good moments in writing. And I think that's the luck I had, I think, that I met those people, but also there was a kind of private, it was almost a private community of people who published books, and you could publish the books the way you wanted to do it, do these books, and also you were never going to be reviewed, and for about 10 years, our books were not reviewed, so that, you know, you didn't have to be judged by strangers. You know, you were read by 500 strangers max, but that was it. And I think that's an opportunity and a kind of a gift that ideally every writer should try and have. I mean, I think the horror of publishing today is that if you want to make it and be published by a major publisher in New York and be judged immediately with, you know, or for 1 weekend and then it's over. And to me, that's a nightmare of the publishing scene right now.
So Kochar's Press, for those of you who don't know, Kochar's Press in Toronto was a press that was dominantly edited by writers.
Yeah, about 8 writers. Well, originally it was Victor Coleman, and then later on there were about 8 editors at the press.
Could you name some of those people?
B.P. Nichol, David Young, Sarah Sheard, Frank Davey for a while, and Bob Wallace did drama. So we had some plays, and Victor was there. So, you know, these were all writers, and they were had a day job. So they were doing it, you know, and they could never agree on what the ideal book was. So we ended up with each of us was allowed to do 2 books that we fervently believed in, even if everybody else hated those 2 books. So it had a kind of open feel, really, of publishing. But it was a kind of... the press no longer exists, but in fact it's slowly starting up again. And they've just done a couple of new books recently. Website, but also actual books as well.
Yes, the company was where I wanted to leave off my biography. I kind of hate this new fashion of biographies of everybody, and unfortunately, there's even one on preparing on me, where I suppose I'll have to be very truthful throughout, or I'll get caught. But the real key into writing was actually the companionship. In particular of Jack Spicer and of Robert Duncan. And that companionship has never left me, even though the companionship has included others, and two of them are here at the table, Robert Creeley and Michael Ondaatje. The conversation, I was talking to Michael Smoller earlier about this, he was asking me about poetic practice and so on, and I said, well, I never feel alone in my poetics. I can't begin with a pre-assigned subject. That was the trouble with the libretto, which is being really quite an extravagant experience, because you have a pre-assigned subject in that condition. I've never done that before in my life. I never wanted to write like W.H. Auden and so on and so forth. The companionship that began there in the intelligence of reading, the intelligence of writing, and the constant converse of it became, in my sense, a kind of poetics that you entered in and discovered what the poem would do as though it were a kind of conversation. And now in my old age, my mind fills with voices. Sometimes I don't know where it's coming from. Something I read last night, The Sounding Air, for example, I know that's from somebody, or at least it doesn't seem to be mine, so it'll either go in little quotation marks or it'll be italics. It just means somebody's talking to me. And it's a wonderful, comfortable way. That's why I protect my mornings generally, so that those are free and quiet with coffee and so on, because all of that, the voicing goes on. So it becomes a companionship. You get older. Of course, your companions are very spread out or in many instances now dead. And so the conversations go on anyway. And I am not talking about a sad condition, because I think poetry is essentially a celebration of everything, including grief, that one celebrates the variability to sound it. And, is that enough? I mean, a sense of companionship.
I'm not the arbiter here. I'm simply listening.
But yes, that companionship was enormously important, and it grew and grew and grew. And I didn't meet Robert Creeley until 1965, which seemed to me very strange, because Creeley was very present, because I'd met Olson in 57, Duncan was over, and on. This just grew, and it becomes a conversation that is not simply a challenge, but an actual world that's very much alive. And so you're just watching what everybody can do.
So would that have been the 1965 Poetry Conference?
1965 Poetry Conference.
In Berkeley.
I remember walking up a path, yeah. Bob said, how strange we haven't met. And I thought, it's even stranger, yeah. Because he'd been so present as Converse. Oh, it was just... So, yes, I don't mean a forced one. I mean, I believe in magic still in an old-fashioned way. And the great magic is in the companionship.
But the musicians of Bremen, yeah.
Yes.
Bob, would you like to say something to this?
For me, that company was absolutely crucial. I used to think of the story of Billy Goat's Gruff, and Olson was the big one, Robert was the middle one, and I was the little one. And I loved, too, the stories such as so-and-so could drink the ocean, so-and-so could live in fire, so-and-so could, you know, stride great seven-league boots. I mean, I always thought that it was an extraordinary company that not only proved resource and response, but that also gave the body communal this extraordinary range and articulation. I mean, people would say at times, how is it that, you know, Olson and me specifically, how is it that you people find each other interesting, you know? In some ways, it was precisely because we could do things the other couldn't, or did do things the other didn't. And that it, but nonetheless, saw it always to a common center of possibility. And it was more, again, like the Sabres, you know? It was a team. I mean, when thankfully I was generously given an award this spring, the great local paper, the awful local paper, Buffalo News, called me up to ask me what I felt. I said, well, you know, poetry is a team sport, so I don't think any one person, I sounded like, you know, Dixon Ward. I don't think any one player owns the whole condition. And I equally think it's very, very much like, say, musicians who are not simply playing in a band, but who are using a tradition and a habit and a resource that's far more extensive than any one person could possibly define or contain. And that there's a not necessarily a benevolent sharing, because there's cutting and argument and person always there as a condition, but the resource is in the company, not in the singular instance. That sadly is often, it happens to younger poets that they are tapped in a curiously disgruntling way and are lifted out into some curious isolation. And they are taken from their peers, really, in some way that makes it very awkward for them to come back to that. I used to see this often, again, with older poets who were world poets, for example, and who lost the culture, the communality that they were otherwise backed on. I think it's absolutely crucial to have that. Mm. The shift in Seamus Heaney, for example. Seamus Heaney, when he first left, he had this extraordinary power. But it wasn't that he became better or worse, but he lost that particularity, that edge of relationship, as opposed to his elder, Patrick Kavanaugh, for example.
Oh, yeah, Patrick Kavanaugh.
You could write doggerel with absolute power.
Within this, there's the sense of the company of books, that sense of your dancer who could read the biography, and that makes him realize there's a concept which his own intelligence can immediately join and elaborate on relative to his own life. Have you had any books that had that effect on you, that showed you ways to go?
No, I'm not very conscious of books influencing me. I mean, not consciously. I mean, I'm books influence me in an unconscious or subconscious way. Much more. And I try not to read books too consciously, for that reason. I mean, I just want to get into the story and get into that world of the book or the thriller or whatever it is, and something's going to stick on the wall, you know, when you finish it, and that would be the influence. You know, I don't want to kind of read this novelist to learn how to write dialogue.
But you don't think that this dancer read this in order? I mean, you read a thing, but you come away with an atmosphere that, in fact, is kindred to your own person.
I think with him, it opened numerous doors that you know, kind of made it possible for him to kind of become a dancer in a way.
They all know what it's about. Okay. I'll be back.
Adieu, adieu.
I don't know what... I think this writer, Sebald, has been the most exciting writer I've read for a while, because it's also on the edge of memoir or history or novel. You're not quite sure what it is. And he's written two books. There are two books that have been published, I think, by New Directions or Grove, or is that the same thing? One is called The Emigrants, and one's called Rings of Saturn, The Rings of Saturn. There are a lot of books. I'm not quite sure how I would begin kind of finding them in my head. You know, I think Gary Snyder's Earth House Hold, you know, which I haven't even looked at for about 25 years. I mean, when I first read that book, I thought of the possibility, which was made up of fragments of journals and some poems, maybe some essays, I don't really know. But it suddenly opened up for me the possibility of one could write a book that was everything, that could contain everything, could contain, you know, fiction and poetry and space and photographs and all these things. And so I think that was, in some ways, an important book for me. But I don't really know what the others are right now.
Bob, do you have anything?
There are books that were touchstones or permissions and instruction, but I don't know that they would be constants for other persons. I don't think they're so specific. And they often, I don't even know that I've remembered them correctly. I don't think that's even to the point that they, I recall, for example, a novel of Conrad's, which begins with a ship with an all-women orchestra playing.
That's Victory.
Victory, yeah, that's an incredible novel. Mm. And that at the very end of the novel, then there's this other person who's thousands of miles distant at that moment as the ship sets off. And then, but at the end of the novel, these two people are so close in this absolutely terrifying existential moment. And I thought, God, how did he do that? I mean, how did he so unobtrusively bring those two people into that peculiar, you know, proximity? So that was fascinating to me. I remember reading The Wanderer, you know, and the poignance of what it meant to be older and coming back to a place where you'd been a child, things of that sort. Or Lawrence, That You Touched Me, or his novels generally, or Dostoevsky, the piece of bread with the hook in it that the kids feed to the dog. Etc. There were moments, but it's very hard to again, as Michael was saying earlier, I would say myself very much, I'm not a literary writer. I was moved, we were at a gathering in respect of Jack Hawks recently, and at one point Jack was talking in a video, and he's saying he's too slow a reader to be a literary writer. I love books, but that has nothing to do with the profession of literature at all. You know, I've been a teacher, but that equally has had even less to do with that, as any student of mine would attest. You know? But I was useless to them as a purveyor of literature, as a codified subject.
When I was 14, I came across Richard Lord Halliburton and the Royal Road to Romance. And this man would go out and get to the place. For instance, he crossed the Alps on elephants. Yeah. While he was writing about Hannibal crossing the Alps on elephants. So he could give you the terrain, and he could give you the weather, the way the weather felt when you were on an elephant in the Alps. And he was finally killed on a Chinese junk trying to cross the Pacific Ocean. I adored him. I absolutely immediately adored him. He was the first literary person I fell in love with. And then I realized that he was dead, and had been dead for a long time. But he was a major love in my life, and there I was in high school reading anything that I could get my hands on. And then later, I started reading Alfred Noyes, who wrote The Highwayman. In my generation, The Highwayman was a classic poem that people were required to read as a part of English lessons. You know, the highwayman came riding, you know, up to the old inn door where, but there was a poem of his that started, there's an organ grinder caroling across a golden street in the city where the sun sinks low and the music isn't Verdi, but time has made it sweet and blah, blah, something sunset glow. And then he suddenly shifts from that into come down to Q in lilac time, in lilac time, in lilac time, come down to Q in lilac time, it isn't far from London. And he's going back and forth between those two tempos. And it hit me like a miracle. It was the first time I ever had the experience of voice shift. I'm sure I'd read it endlessly, instances of it before. But suddenly, it was so patent. Now, those two things in my very youthful history, I would never have mentioned in literary company, except that at one point, talking to Joanne Kiger, Joanne said, oh yes, when I was in high school in Santa Barbara, we had a Richard Lord Halliburton fan club. And we all adored Richard Lord Halliburton. And one summer, when Alan was here, he began talking about Alfred Noyes. And I suddenly thought that these things I thought of as youthful pleasures, in fact, did continue within some kind of literary possibility, that I didn't have to not mention them as if they were instances of myself in childhood, you know.
Alfred Noyes was at Berkeley, University of California's resident poet when I arrived there.
Really?
Yes, and I'm amazed I mixed up The Highwayman Comes Riding.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. But he didn't allow for much contemporary poetry.
Well, he was a romantic, and there was a point there where we all snubbed romance. I mean, you know.
I have never snubbed romance.
Of course not. Not really. I have the sense that it would be really nice if we had a larger chunk than usual of questions being asked and answered, if that's all right with you. I'd like to open this up to the students. Would you please, anyone who has a question, come to the microphone, because this is being videotaped and is being taped.
Oh, dear.
And so we need it on, we need to get your voice here.
I was just curious, Bobby, talking in the same sense of geography and poetics, about which non-English languages everybody learned and why they learned it and how that changed their sense of what home or company or geography might be. So I just was, as I was listening, I was wondering if you spoke Swahili or, you know, whatever language it was that changed the geography space.
I have been, I'm very bad on languages. I mean, I haven't learned any languages apart from English since the age of about 11. When I was growing up in Sri Lanka, I could speak English and Sinhala, a bit of Tamil, which I then didn't speak, and I left till I forgot the languages. And since then, I've been, no other languages. R.K. Narayan, the Indian writer, was asked why he wrote in English, and he said, well, I've only got, this guy's about 95 years old, he said, I've only had time to learn one language properly. And I guess that's the sense I have now. I mean, I'd love to have learned or remembered Sinhala, but that's the only language I want to learn, I think, not specifically French or Spanish.
But so when you're writing about Sri Lanka, is there a sense that Tamil influences that writing?
Well, I wonder. I don't know. I don't know if those languages I knew as a child, in fact, got buried within the English somewhere or the rhythms. I mean, I've certainly read a lot of writing in translation and stuff like that. Or I would know certain street songs that I would remember, but maybe those rhythms or methods of storytelling would have influenced my English in some way. But it would have influenced the English or pushed the English, I think, as opposed to being another language.
Michael, are you going to be reading from the new book?
No. Well,
tomorrow
when book of poems.
I just was responding directly to that because I think you hear those new poems they're marvelous and they pick up. It's not simply the information. But there's something in the meter of these new poems that seems to me to be coming from somewhere else and very different from the earlier poetry. Yeah. You know how much I like the book, I think you will hear some of this other language, other world moving in the poems I presume Michael will be reading tomorrow. Oh, yes, well.
I just supposed to stay here.
Yes, well.
I can run.
Well, yes, that was simply an emergency phone call for both of us a few moments ago, as far as biographers are concerned. So I'm, my... My sense is that I was totally homeless. And I don't mean that in a self-pitying way. I really do think of my American, really to find home somehow, to be at home, not to find it so much as to be at home. And I grow up in a very mixed family. The maternal side of it is a proud and old American family that comes out of the Northeast. Some of it attaches when it was still New Amsterdam, for example, and they would go on and on about it. And there were proud elements that I won't bring up, but I always thought they were probably lies until one time when I was able to go to the university that I always wanted to go to, and that was the one that Hawthorne went to in Maine, there's a picture there of someone that my maternal side of the family claimed, and that was the painter Benjamin West. So I go there with a group of people from Cambridge, Mass, and we wander up there, and they are ahead of me, and there are screams. They went around a corner. There's Gilbert Stuart's portrait, not very big, of Benjamin West, and it's spit an image. Spit an image. And I'd never gotten to that college. That was a daydream in reading Hawthorne stories as a child. Because you had that kind of, now the paternal side of the family is immigrant. and they are not proud of it. It came from Toulouse. And my grandfather, they came over, they all wind up working on the railroads, and they all become Mormons. That's what you do when you give up Catholicism. And, well, it'll be my exception, if you'll excuse me. He spoke both German and French, only to me, and would play games with me, the one that I've usually used, and I think it's in an essay somewhere or another, the radio playing, you know, tu es la crème de mon café, tu es le pot de ma soupe. Well, that's a very good song for a boy, a little boy, you know, growing up. And so it was there. So you've got a mix of some kind. Also, it was an educated and very, very... When I go home now, I have two brothers and a sister. And in particular, I wish I hadn't been sent off to all the schools and things, which gives me... I talk in what used to be called a university accent. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't mind at all to have that twang. Mm-hmm. My both brothers have got it, and I sometimes go back to get a shot in the arm. It's just a knockout. Plus, they come up with metaphors that I couldn't possibly. My brother was trying to explain some neighbor that he didn't like, and he said, he's hung like a hummingbird. And to this day, you know, I think I'll just take it and sign my name to it. I'm trying to say there's a marvelous life in the sound, mm-hmm. all of which, I mean, you know, they sent me to places they gave us, it was called elocution. And you were taught very carefully not to say in the American Idaho, probably called has for has, an Italian name, please, has. You would have come, no, has. None of that style. And so, okay, so it's gone in some way. I'm not sorry about it. I'm just saying, you asked about how are you home in your language. I wasn't in some way. Mm-hmm. And as a consequence, what you're doing is going through an enormous amount. And so translation becomes an absolute experience for me. There's nothing like sitting there and trying very hard to bring something over and knowing very damn well that there is no language behind these languages that they like to teach you. Try some Greek sometime, if you're anybody that goes on into classics. It's a terrific idea. The greatest of all Greek dictionaries makes every translation abstract. When you read Homer, the translator is going to tell you he raised his sword. That is not what the Greek says. It says his breast went burp and the sword went up. That's a very, that's the way I want my world. You know, my breast went, and boy, I killed that, whatever. You know, actually, I wouldn't. I'd probably do something else. But it's, so I felt not only homeless in place, and then displaced, and fed on marvelous, marvelous stories all the time, like this wonderful things that Bob was talking. Those are just, you sit there forever trying to, that under the bridge. To this day, I can't go across a small bridge where I'm not sure that they're under the bridge. And how many years later before you see the play in which that's absolutely Peer Gynt stuff, you know. So there's another one that you do. And I think these are where the experience is really very much a kind of map that belongs to you, and then you're constantly looking for not the border, but the horizon where all these companions turn up with the absolute richness of their language, of their words, and of course that means the experience.
Yeah. You actually make me feel, I was born in El Paso, spent the first 4 years of my life there, and then moved to Brooklyn, and then by circumstance wound up at Harvard also, and spent the first 2 years, I think, at Harvard just trying to get rid of my Brooklyn accent that would sometimes slip into this weird other accent, which was probably derived from my early childhood. So I had that same feeling of homelessness, which is why I'm kind of asking, like, what is the voice that you feel most comfortable speaking when your voice slips between these geographies, in this case, El Paso, Brooklyn, to some kind of elocution that was demanded?
Massachusetts.
I didn't go to Harvard, I went to Harvard.
I love that, there's that charming, really interesting recording of Whitman that survived, that has that, and you suddenly recognize that he's classic New Jersey, ample. I love the way he says ample. It's, you know, suddenly there's an absolutely evident and real person, and he's wonderful, and it's completely northern New Jersey.
Bob, what I was asking was, if learning other languages or being
I never did.
We have, yeah. Or if that had ever, does that change the sense of geography or poetics?
I don't think so. I think I like that sense. Well, Warren Tallman had it immensely, the mother tongue. And Olson's sense of what the language one is given with one's mother's milk. I mean, the language, that's why I feel at home in Maine, although I never spoke it. In the sense, because all of my nurturing elders after my father's death were women and men from Maine. Although we lived in Massachusetts, they all spoke in the intimate condition this other way. But there's a hidden fact there, thinking of what Robin was saying, that my grandfather, my mother spoke French, but it was because of the social biases of that time and place, and even she never spoke it to the children, only to her mother. Only to her father. Her mother didn't speak French, I don't think. I thought that my Uncle Archie, I didn't realize his name was Achille, for example, or that Uncle Gus was Gustave, you know, things like that. So that even then there was a curious fracture in the language. There was also the fracture between the urban, e.g. Watertown, edge of Boston, a voice from the plains, for example, Eileen. That voice and the country voice. I mean, in those days, 30 miles was like England. It was a very different accent. So I was curiously flummoxed in those. And then I went to this boys' school at sophomore year in high school. And again, the whole accent did another change. And then Harvard, as you know, was forget it. You know.
Forget
I used to go to Arlington.
Exactly.
I used to walk up Mass Avenue until I got to Arlington to speak English. You know.
Yeah.
Thank you, Peter.
That thing about Whitman, I just last year I heard Ted Hughes, a tape of him reading for the first time. I'd read his stuff, but I hadn't heard him. And what was remarkable, he was reading The Perch or The Trout or one of those fish poems anyway, but it was remarkable because it changed completely because he had this thick Yorkshire accent, which had suddenly made the poem and all his work very personal. You know, it wasn't the official English voice that he was coming from him. It was a local voice. It was very exciting.
I remember once years ago when Ron Lowenson was visiting, and Ron Lowenson was going to be reading at the University of New Mexico, and we dropped children off at my mother's, and my Aunt Thelma and my Aunt Dorothy and my Uncle Marin were all sitting in this around the table in the kitchen, so we come in through the door and it's instantly, well, hello, Bobby. We hadn't seen you in a long time. And I say, no, how long's it been? Well, it's been on, we're instantly launched. We came out of there with Ron looking like he'd been given an injection. I mean, he was sort of walking toward the car and Bob said, what's the matter? And he said, I've never been in a room with that many of those people speaking like that.
We've already been all those people.
Yeah. But I made a point of learning to speak English and drop Texan. I was the youngest member of a radio acting company at the age of 14 and a half. And I was there expressly because I knew I was aiming at a person I meant to be way down the line, and that person was not going to have a Texas accent.